Welcome back, everyone, for another edition of Cannabis Q&A with our special guest, Dr. Mitch Earlywine, joining us by telephone. Hello, Dr. Mitch.
Hey, hey.
We're back. It's been a while since we had the chance to talk to you. I hope everything has gone well for you this summer.
In fact, it has, and the semester's starting off really nicely.
Any new research papers or studies that you guys are working on there in Albany?
Believe it or not, we're going to prove the obvious yet again with a new study on cannabis and sleep. What a surprise. It's a big help.
Well, all right. If anyone's interested in those kind of studies or has suggestions for others, remember, you can always email Dr. Mitch at 420research@gmail.com. And speaking of the 420 research, we've got a whole bunch of studies to take a look at, some good, some bad, on today's episode. Let's start with this one because it's has to do with a substance I'd never heard of before, acetylcysteine, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, and this study that says there's no evidence that this drug, which they'd used on adolescents to get them to stop smoking pot, doesn't work so well on adults. Can you clue us in on this supposed anti-pot substance?
Well, so the thing to understand is this really works in glutamate, the system that's sort of the newest of the neurotransmitter systems that have been discovered. If you know MSG, the monosodium glutamate, you sort of know the role of it. The bottom line was they had some evidence when this was used in conjunction with a pretty strict behavioral intervention with adolescents, it did help those adolescents be more likely to give clean urine screens. It's not generalizing to the adults. I'm not sure why. My first suspicion was, oh, they don't have enough statistical power. As it turns out, they've got over 300, or they've got 300 adults in this study. I'm starting to wonder if maybe the first one was a fluke. The glutamate system is pretty far downstream from the cannabinoid system, and I'm guessing that this certainly isn't going to work by itself. And we need more evidence to see if it would really help. But in truth, I wish they were measuring cannabis problems rather than urine screens. So I don't really care if somebody smokes a joint once in a while. I just want to see that they don't develop any problems. And I somehow doubt that they need to have their glutamate receptors tinkled in order to do that.
I'm wondering, what is the mechanism for this N-acetylcysteine? Is it like, I mean, I used to hear of antabuse that would make alcoholics sick if they drank alcohol. Does it work like that? Does it cause some sort of physical reaction to cannabis?
Fortunately, no. What has happened is they've sort of generalized from other animal literature where the rodents, basically, who got this were just less likely to press the bar for some of the psychostimulants, cocaine and amphetamine and the Adderall type ones. And they thought, well, let's go ahead and try it on humans and with some other drugs. It doesn't seem to really generalize, and the tacit assumption that somehow you just need glutamate to function differently in order to avoid cannabis is pretty far away from the more direct idea of, say, using THC, which is pretty comical, or using some kind of cannabinoid blocker, which would just be depressing and terrible.
All right. Well, the big story that we have in drug reform these days has to do, of course, with the unfolding opiate overdose crisis. And one of the ways this ties into the marijuana world is that we hear reports from high-ranking officials. Even Senator Rob Portman from Ohio once mentioned something about fentanyl-laced marijuana, that heavy-duty opioid that's, you know, so much stronger than heroin or morphine, supposedly being added to samples of marijuana and then sold on the streets, and then people overdose from it. Now, the myth-debunking site Snopes has come out to say this is false. And Dr. Mitch, I just wanted to know if you had anything to add about this scare about the fentanyl-laced marijuana.
I mean, as soon as I heard about this, I thought, who in their right mind would do this? Fentanyl is really pricey. Fentanyl's really hard to get, and it's an opiate. So nobody who wants cannabis really wants it, and it's not like lacing your cannabis with fentanyl is going to somehow save you money or anything. So it just seemed cockamamie from the beginning, and I'm glad to see that it's been debunked. And I feel like this is just another problem with the underground market. We should all be able to go to the store and make sure our cannabis is really cannabis.
It reminds me of the scare of the pot-laced Halloween candy that we're due for here at the end of this month, where supposedly we're going to replace a 15-cent Tootsie Roll with a $15 Chiba Chew.
I sure would like to come to that house.
All right. We were speaking earlier about mice getting high, and there's another study out with mice showing a potential therapeutic use of phytocannabinoids, the scientific term for plant-based cannabinoids, or THC, CBD, etc., in alcohol-related problems. So if we've got a problem with alcoholic mice, Dr. Mitch, can we get them high?
As it turns out, we just might. I liked the previous study better because it was really looking at neurological damage created by alcohol. This is about a stimulating effect that seems to happen in response to alcohol and tends to get worse as the doses increase across time. When you've got THC in particular in the mouse's system, they do end up not showing that exaggerated hyperkinetic sort of spazzy reaction to alcohol later on, and that's a good sign that cannabis might be a buffer against alcohol-related problems in general, but that's not a problem that's really a big one for humans as far as I'm concerned.
You know, I always wondered if mice ever got together for, like, their high school reunions to talk about the studies they've been on. How was it for you, Bob? Well, I had a human ear sewed to me. How was it for you? Hey, I got drunk as hell. All right, let's get to some of these other studies. There's a study that concludes, some of these are some bad news studies from our point of view, a study that concluded that cannabis use appears to increase rather than decrease the risk of developing non-medical prescription opioid use and opioid use disorder. Now, this is NIDA coming out with this, supposedly rebutting the idea that cannabis helps reduce the opiate crisis. So what can we learn from this?
Well, so the way they ask the question is a little asked backwards compared to the way we've seen it done in the past. So Philippe Lucas, some of my data, those studies, we tend to ask folks who are medical cannabis users, what are you using it for? And they say, I'm doing it to get off opiates. That's delightful, and I certainly believe them and think it's a neat approach. What they did in this study was just ask folks who have used cannabis, have they also used non-medical prescription opiates? And of course they have. People who like to use drugs like to use drugs. That's not exactly news, but it certainly doesn't mean that the cannabis caused this. It says there's a subset of folks who are interested in experimenting in sort of thrill and adventure and drug use. So I understand their concern. It is true that people who use cannabis are more at risk for developing other drug problems, but that doesn't mean that cannabis couldn't help these folks get off the opiates if they were motivated.
You know, this ties into some statistics I read Maya Zalovitz put out recently, where she talked about a national survey on drug use and health showing that people who ended up with a dependency problem on opiates, more than half of them got that through getting it from someone they knew, a friend or a family member who had a prescription for it. So is this to say then that the folks who aren't so worried about breaking the social norms of marijuana being illegal also aren't so worried about breaking the social norms of getting your own prescription when you have a backache rather than borrowing someone else's?
Exactly. And I do feel like this says more about people than it does about the plant.
Okay. Another study coming out says enacting medical cannabis laws increases Social Security disability insurance claims, and that could cause an increased reliance on costly social insurance programs. Basically trying to say if you legalize the medical marijuana, you're going to have more people sucking off the government teat. What's the gist of this study?
So 58 pages into this, I finally found like what's really going on, and it's a whopping 0.27% increase.
So oh my.
I don't really feel like we can make too much of this. Yes, it's statistically significant because the sample is enormous. And then they were trying to say something about workman's comp, too, but when you start adding the covariates that you should normally add, like gender and socioeconomic status and things like that, it wasn't significant anymore. So I admire the savvy that these guys went through. They did a ton of really good regression analyses, tested all the assumptions, but the size of this effect is so small and only significant because the sample is so big that it doesn't make any sense to me. And I want to emphasize that people don't pass medical cannabis laws at random. It could very well have been that folks who were already hurting and, you know, essentially qualified for disability were also the same folks who voted for those laws in the first place.
Also, something like this wouldn't take into account the reductions in public costs that you get from not busting patients who might be trying to use cannabis to get by.
Oh, and just the number who aren't going to end up in jail because they're infuriated.
Yeah, there we go. our final bit of science and health news in the world of cannabis today comes from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, who are urging pregnant women to discontinue marijuana use, even for medical purposes. You know, we don't usually get any good news from the medical associations. They seem to be really stuck in the status quo. Is this something that pregnant women should be taking to heart, or maybe with a little of a grain of salt?
Well, it's funny because there aren't any new data here at all. They literally just cited the old studies that we've mentioned before. There are some studies where it really does say, hey, you're more likely to end up with your baby in the NICU if you're a heavy cannabis user, even after we've covaried out all these socioeconomic things. I can't, you know, say, oh, hey, no problem, don't worry, but I feel like these guys came out in this direction in part because they're afraid if they say anything else, they're really going to get in trouble. So I don't know what to say. If you're super nauseated during pregnancy or if you're already a medical cannabis user, talk it over with your physician. Go ahead and take a look at those original data, because we're talking about, you know, at most a doubling of the risk for some of these things. And I would bet that if you took good care of your health in all these other domains, things would be fine, but I'm not an obstetrician.
All right, we'll have to leave it at that. Dr. Mitch Earlywine is a board member for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws and the author of numerous books on cannabis and health. So make sure you check him out. And Dr. Mitch, you can reach him at 420research@gmail.com. Mitch, thanks so much for joining us again here for some cannabis Q&A.
Nice to hear your voice. Talk to you later.